It was not long before this Tibetan, who had boldly stepped forward to protest, literally took to his heels, accompanied by a few other Tibetans who had also returned to protest. They all ran away, and the pious Lama quietly continued his business. The greater the quackery in a Tibetan monastery, the larger the crowd. One cannot help thinking, therefore, that most Tibetans did you really sink in, friend? He asked mildly. Yes, replied the Tibetan, and I was nearly drowned. I went down in the water as quickly as a person wearing ordinary shoes. A murmur went through the crowd. The Lama raised his voice. I shall tell you why these shoes are of no use to you, he said. The miracle shoes are holy, and if sinners wear them, they lose their magical powers. I always walk with them on the surface of rivers and lakes if no witnesses are present, and if another person who is not too bad a sinner complies with my instructions and tries them out alone, they always work. The Tibetan was greatly humiliated on being called a bad sinner in the presence of the large crowd, and the Lama went on, speaking louder and louder, presenting the poor chap to the crowd as a living example of a man leading a sinful life. It was not long before this Tibetan, who had boldly stepped forward to protest, literally took to his heels, accompanied by a few other Tibetans who had also returned to protest. They all ran away, and the pious Lama quietly continued his business. The greater the quackery in a Tibetan monastery, the larger the crowd. One cannot help thinking, therefore, that most Tibetans like to be cheated, and that they create the quacks by the desight of the individual to be cheated. Perhaps this is why the wise men of Tibet do not succeed in changing Tibet. Chapter 7 Eternal Youth. There is nothing more wonderful than youth, youthful enthusiasm, the capacity to feel deeply and to experience the profound ecstasy of life. Is it inevitable that we must lose this glorious thing, youth, slowly and inexorably? The art of keeping young is quite a different matter to merely lengthening our lives. At the time of the 30 Years' War, when whole countries in Europe lost about half their population by war, famine, and pestilence, the average lifetime of man was 10 years. Last century it was 30 to 40 years. Today it is nearly 60 years, and serious scientists speak of the possibility of lengthening, very soon, the average lifetime of humanity to 80 years. All this progress is more apparent than real. The statistics do not state at what age man begins to be old. Man living say 300 years ago probably kept young longer than our contemporaries. In this world of ready-made pleasures and tonics, in this world of so-called intense life which in most cases is nothing more than the seeking of speed and sensation in order to forget one's own terrible emptiness and unhappiness, men and women age far too quickly. Most people get old and disillusioned very early. Even if life itself does not flee, the greatest thing on earth, youth, is rapidly lost. The masses in Tibet make other mistakes, mostly of a spiritual nature, and they also age prematurely, but the real Tibetan hermits manage to remain young almost indefinitely. There are rumors in Tibet that some of these men are 500 or 600 years old. But such stories may be true or they may not be true. It is impossible to prove man's age once he is supposed to be several hundred years old, since he outlives all witnesses. However, some of these men, who look like healthy men of about 35 years of age, must be at least 100 years old, as very many old people living in the same districts have seen these men during 50 or 60 years or more and declare they have not changed their appearance during this period and that they certainly have not grown older. What is the secret of their practically everlasting youth? The best opportunity of studying such a man was offered to me when I stayed for 5 days in the abode of a brother of one of my best friends in Tibet. Both are hermits who seem to possess the power to maintain themselves young almost indefinitely. One of them lives south of the Gobi Desert. Incidentally, it was this man who procured me Tibetan clothes and greatly improved my accent by marvelous pronunciation exercises. His brother lives in southwestern Tibet, and it was the latter who offered me hospitality in his abode. These hermits do not share the view, so common amongst the so-called saints of Tibet, that dirt is a sign of holiness. They are just as clean outwardly as they are inwardly. Their clothes are neither rich nor excessively shabby. Only a few of them are exceptionally tall, and although they eat very little, and in fine and clear weather, sometimes nothing at all, they are not very thin. It must be admitted, however, that they do not seem to carry a single grain of fat. There was a wonderful atmosphere of serenity in my Tibetan friend's abode. There was a marvelous atmosphere of real hospitality, hospitality so natural and effortless that one felt at home at once. For 3 days after I arrived he had hardly eaten anything, and I had begun to wonder whether it was his fast which kept him so young. He looked like a man of about 30. And he sometimes behaved like a boy. Also, his eyes were more the eyes of a boy than those of a fully grown man. His real age, judging from the reliable statements of numerous old people who had seen him many decades ago, must have been 90 years at least. There was nothing solemn and awe-inspiring about him, and one morning when we jokingly pushed each other about to get some exercise, I clasped his body. It was elastic and lithe, like the body of a boy of 19. Again, I wondered whether his eating so little had something to do with his youthful appearance. I just thought this, without asking him. He smiled, looked at me fully with his brilliant eyes, which continually changed their expression, and said, "It is not fasting that keeps me young, my friend." "Why do you eat so little, then?" I asked. "Because I am practically never hungry," he answered. "Now, listen very carefully," he went on, after a slight pause. "The moment you make an effort to remain young, you get older. The very moment you make an effort to keep something, you are afraid to lose it. And fear poisons a man, no matter what he does or what he eats. It is fear that destroys people's youth. Don't forget that all in life is relative, and that there are no absolute values. Even good or evil do not really exist. Nothing is really good or really bad. It all depends on how we use a thing. You can't keep young by certain practices. If we are old at heart, physical old age quickly follows, no matter what we eat or what we do to keep young. And what is youth? It is freedom from prejudice, freedom from habitual ways of thinking and habitual ways of living. So long as we are spontaneous, loving, and enthusiastic, we are young. This is very simple," I ventured to remark. "But most people would like a miraculous liquid giving them everlasting youth." "Precisely," he replied, "but such a thing as an elixir giving eternal youth does not exist. Do not think I am brutal when I show you the world as it really is. If we give the world an elixir of eternal youth, we should only make things worse. Many people use their lives to work harm to others while making now and then a short effort to be good, thus having an excuse for being mischievous all the rest of the time. And how about the unemployment problem?" He added with a significant wink, showing that he knew more about the West than I had imagined. "And how about the problem of overpopulation?" His voice became infinitely sad. "In a world where man is the enemy of man, a lengthened life only creates additional disorder. Lengthening people's lives without changing their hearts would only increase the disorder and suffering in the world. All the troubles of the world are caused by the erroneous attitude of the individual who seeks his own happiness at the expense of the happiness of others. By merely fighting the symptoms of that trouble, which include premature old age, we do not make things better. We have fought the symptoms of selfishness for centuries past, and in spite of this the world has become more and more unhappy." "Are you happy?" I asked. Tears streamed down his face while he made his answer. "No, I am not. People of my type are often heartbreakingly lonely, if you look at it from a purely human angle. I love others, and yet I feel how infinitely little I can do for them. There is deep tragedy in this. I cannot be happy before the whole world is happy, and there is a long Calvary, an infinitely long Calvary, still ahead of us before that goal is reached." I suddenly could not help thinking of a conversation I once had with a learned theologian with whom I had discussed the pleasures of paradise and the sufferings of the damned. He had seemed to feel that one should not bother much about hell once one is certain that one gets to paradise oneself. But to revert to my conversation, is life worth living? I asked the hermit. Yes, he replied, life is great, life is glorious. There is always that alternative between vertiginous summits and dreadful chasms. All is relative and there is no certainty. If you realize this, you can live with the heart of a boy. Only if you live with the heart of a boy is life worth living. Then you know many things and yet you do not feel superior. I do not think I am an exceptional individual. I am just a humble servant of humanity. I live and love. What can we do for the world? I asked. We can be signposts, showing the way to those groping in the darkness. But woe to them if they begin to worship us. If people wait for signposts to help them, signposts become the greatest hindrance. But how shall we begin to influence others practically? Most people contribute in some way or other to the sufferings of the world, often without even knowing it themselves, he replied. All a sincere man can do is not to cooperate with anything he considers stupid, no matter what may be the result for his life and property. He suddenly began to laugh like a naughty boy, his outburst of boyish vivacity strangely contrasting with his serious manner a few moments before. I must laugh, he said, when using the word property, for I have no property. I have nothing, so I am not afraid to lose anything. Shall we recommend people to seek poverty? I asked. No. There is no harm in riches if a people do not cling to them. So that contempt of money, riches, and power need not be a first step. No. It comes by itself, once people have understood life. What should be the first step, then? Understand one's self. It is much easier to understand others than it is to understand ourselves. Don't you think that it is easier for a person to understand the child of someone else, than it is to understand his own child? The more prejudiced and selfishly interested in a thing we are, the more difficult it is to understand. Is there anything which is more difficult to judge objectively than ourselves? Tell people to become fully aware of themselves. Tell them to inquire continually into their own motives, to be brutally open to themselves. That may provide the first incentive to the realization of one's own insufficiencies and thus a first step towards understanding. After all, it is very simple. Love. Love more and more intensely. And if your love is free from the poison of egocentrism, you will not feel superior because you have a deeper understanding. If real love begets understanding, this understanding will be free from the dreadful pitfall of spiritual arrogance. My wise friend did everything himself. Mealtime had come, and he prepared our food. I had a little barley meal with some dried radishes, whereas his meal consisted of perhaps 2 or 3 teaspoonfuls of a mixture of herbs that one of his friends had brought down for him from the Himalayas. I received a little bag of these 3 months ago, he said. There is still much left in it. Few Westerners would be content with a meal like this, I observed. I do not suggest for a moment that they should eat such food. There is much good in all the progress of civilization, he returned, but people make a mess out of it. The more they invent machinery, the more they complicate life. So in the end they are none the better for it. I should not mind using some Western machinery up here, he added. Why should I work an hour a day for a month on my clothes if the same work can be done by a machine in 10 minutes? Well, why don't you get one? I asked. I should become too conspicuous up here if I used machinery, he answered, and then I should hasten the progress of Western penetration here in Tibet, which has already started near the borders of the country, and also in some parts of the Lhasa district. Have you a connection with the Lhasa district? I asked, rather surprised. I thought this district was one of the most isolated in Tibet. Never mind how I get my information, he replied meaningly. If you go to the Lhasa district yourself, you may check up whether I am right. But you cannot go there on this trip. It would not be safe, for you would have to travel in disguise in a district where many white people have already been seen by the inhabitants. Perhaps I shall go there on my next visit to Tibet in 5 or 6 years, I said. Don't be so rash as to make plans, friend, he said. There may be gigantic upheavals interfering with your plans, although nothing is definitely determined as yet. It all depends on what every one of us is doing. One good thought may pull down the scales in the right direction. Why do you not wish Western progress to come to Tibet? I asked. The West makes the horrible mistake of overemphasizing the importance of matter. This part of the world makes the opposite mistake. Tibet runs away from the material aspect. By bringing machinery up here, we should make the pendulum swing in the opposite direction, and the people inevitably would become materialists. A new conception of life is necessary all over the world, he went on more loudly. It was as though he had forgotten all about me and spoke to humanity as a whole. The West runs away from spirit and the East runs away from matter. The few people in the West who make an effort to be religious are just like the common folk in the East, they run away from matter, too. And the few people in the East who, by an effort, break away from what they call religion become materialists like most Western people. Unless we create a new conception of life, he went on, both the East and the West are doomed. We need a new type of humanity which is both matter and spirit. Only such people can be human. A person running away either from matter or from spirit, never is. He led me to the door of his abode. A glorious landscape lay before our eyes. The air was as clear as crystal. At a distance of about 8 English miles, about 2,500 feet below us, there was a mountain lake. My Tibetan friend showed me an island in the lake. He said that Tibetan hermits lived on the island, and the population considered it their duty to bring food to them. All the winter the lake was frozen until late in the spring, and the food supply was very easy to obtain until then. But when the summer came on, rafts could not at first be used, while the ice was melting, as Tibetan rafts consist of blown-up bags made of hides. Then people risk their lives to bring food to the hermits by walking over the surface of the melting ice. The so-called hermits consider their prayers more effective on the island than elsewhere, and do not want to pray elsewhere, even at the cost of endangering other people's lives. Here you see an example of people running away from matter, my friends said. They pray, and are good while they pray, but they are not good in their daily lives. Can you imagine a really humane being praying on an island, and by doing so, forcing other people to risk their lives when walking over the ice? Beware of people who think they are good, my friend, he added. In most cases we are worst when we imagine we are good. I had to think of cruel idealists and the wars of religion. I had to think of the fact that for centuries past a large number of various systems have been established for helping others and for making others better, and that in spite of this the world seems to be a veritable lunatic asylum of stupidities and horrible suffering. Many of us try to be good, but often we are good only for a few minutes now and then. And our ideals and short moments of kindness and benevolence only provide us with an excuse for being hypocritical egotists all the rest of our time. Many of us are idealists because it pays to be idealists. Such idealism has no value at all. On the contrary, it helps to cover up symptoms, thus preventing the world from seeing the underlying causes of our troubles. Let us fight selfishness and imperfection in ourselves and not in others. The world would be much better and much more human if people devoted to judging themselves only a tenth part of the energies they waste on judging others in thought, words, or action. Unlike most other Tibetans who begin to discover how they should live only when their lives are nearly gone, the real Tibetan hermits have the courage to live their own lives undisturbed by habits and prejudices. They are always in love with life while they live. Their outlook on life is a living and dynamic reality. They do not wish anything, not even a long life or health or happiness. They just live without crippling their lives or allowing them to be crippled by others, which attitude requires a good deal of determination in this world. They treat everything kindly, although occasionally they may be harsh to individuals when you think life as a whole demands it, and this everything also includes their own bodies. They never ill-treat them. They do not desire anything, and yet everything is given to them. Strangely enough, their not desiring anything seems to be coupled with an unflinching willpower, But this willpower is never used from the point of view of the I, but always from the point of view of everything which also includes the I. They are very wise, probably just because of the fact that they do not accumulate learning like a miser who accumulates gold. They do not judge things with the brain only, but with the brain and the heart. And that is wisdom, namely, not merely the accumulating and cataloguing of innumerable details, but the grasping of vital connections. Someone killing specimens of all unknown species of animals in Tibet, for instance, and examining them very thoroughly, would not be any the wiser for it. Has our civilization, with all its learning and ever-increasing technical improvements and facilities, made us wise and happy? Has our enormous knowledge and information made us wiser than those Tibetan hermits? Certainly not. For we have merely accumulated learning and lack the wisdom to put all this learning and all these improvements to good and constructive purposes. Even the common Tibetan folk in parts of Tibet, where information about the West is available, do not want Western civilization. It brings only unhappiness and strife, they say. It is not wanted here. Shall we destroy civilization and climb the trees because we are not wise enough to use it as it ought to be used? If the heart of man changes, civilization will cease to defeat its own purpose. After all, is civilization good or bad? Nothing is good or bad. It all depends on how we use it. The technical and scientific aspect of civilization has progressed at a stupendous rate, but, during these times of rapid material progress, the heart of man has hardly changed, in spite of whole centuries of talking about love and brotherhood. Is there really a difference between the man who went to the circus 1800 years ago to see people torn to pieces by lions, and the modern man who goes to the circus when there is the prospect of an acrobat breaking his neck? All Tibetan sellers of spiritual drugs encourage the belief that if one gets near a very saintly person, the very fact of proximity will help one automatically, and will be of spiritual benefit. In the realm of real spirituality, there can be no advantage. Even the presence of a great and dynamic being does not automatically help one. It merely sets loose everything that is hidden in us, and not only our light sides, but also the other ones. Small wonder that the real hermits are so reluctant to meet the curious multitude. The real hermits never call themselves saints. Beware of people who make such an effort to convince you that they are good or moral. If someone really is virtuous, he need not emphasize the fact. Only once I asked a Tibetan saint whether he was virtuous. His answer was a merry laugh. And yet I am convinced that he never sinned. The guiding principle of his life was love. He never did to others what he didn't want others to do to him. That was his moral code, he told me afterwards. This hermit who, of course, also knew that I was a white person, gave me answers to very vital questions. Tell me whether you have found reality, I asked him. Reality, truth, life, God, eternity, all-embracing love, all these are one and the same thing, he answered. You cannot find truth. The moment you have your truth, it is no longer truth. As long as we live, we must seek, he went on. Life would have no meaning if there was anything certain. The more you are pushed about by life, the better. Never be satisfied, especially with yourself. Is there no guiding principle? I asked. There is one, he said, while his eyes lit up with infinite love and compassion. The guiding principle should be love. If you are true to it, it shows the right way. We had come up from the valley where I had crossed the river on my floating device just before meeting him. After answering my last question, he increased his speed. So did I. I can walk at 6 miles an hour without running. But the Tibetan walked faster still. Are there no pitfalls on the way? I asked. There is one. The most dreadful of all sins, spiritual arrogance. If love opens your heart to deeper understanding and you misuse the light thus given by feeling superior and contempting others, then you commit the greatest sin against your true self. He again increased his speed. Now it was 7 miles an hour, and I could not follow him without running. I realized that he wished to be left alone. The Tibetan Nalayopas never make an effort to be kind. They do not hesitate to be firm if they wish to bring an interview to a conclusion. I stopped for a moment and looked behind me. When I turned again a few seconds later, he was no longer in sight. This was perhaps my strangest experience during my travels in Asia. Now he was alone again physically, but telepathically he was probably in contact with all corners of the universe. Imagine a man knowing so much, and being so immeasurably wise, and yet being unable to help his fellow creatures directly. These men never try to influence other people's free will. Life would have no meaning if we just became puppets, automatically following the dictates of spiritual leaders, be they ever so wise and powerful. Man has the choice between the greatest good and the most horrible evil. His fate lies in his own hands. That is the glory of man. Someday he will save himself by his own effort and become like the wise men of Tibet. They are analogous to signposts. They say so themselves. Man creates his own limitations. He himself must destroy the things he has created. The hermits could demonstrate to children how they walk, but if they carried them in their arms, the children would never learn to walk. The real hermits are beyond criticism. They do not care whether they are praised or blamed. The opinion of other people, which to most Tibetans is so important that their whole lives bear the stamp of the automatic thoughts and prejudices of the epoch in which they happen to live, does not seem to influence the wise men of Tibet in any way. These spontaneously unselfish men, who do not make any virtue of their unselfishness, but who are continually and effortlessly kind and compassionate, seem to have conquered death. They are eternal, seeing that the very notion of time only exists insofar as the individual draws a borderline between the I and the non-I, and considers everything in relation to his little self. And as they are eternal in the above sense, these men are not afraid of death, although their I does not believe in any particular personal paradise where it would be comfortably housed. However, these men are fully conscious of being distinct and separate entities and do not give up their soul. They are and remain strong personalities who work out of love for others. And this is nirvana, real nirvana, about which so many false notions prevail, not only in Western countries, but also in the East, as real nirvana is very often mistaken for so-called nirvana, which is a fabrication of the priests. False nirvana is an abolishment and negation of life, but real nirvana is its full unfoldment by the spiritualization of matter, instead of running away from it or overemphasizing its importance. Real nirvana is a state in which man is everything and nothing at the same time. It is a state of being past death, past the fear of death. This replacing of the boundless selfishness of the I by a voluntarily limited selfishness is not annihilation but a different state of consciousness. Such an I puts itself voluntarily at the disposal of the world and works for the world, because it feels one with all the joys and sorrows of the world and not because it is promised some selfish reward, be it ever so subtle. To understand the full significance of real nirvana, it must be approached with the brain and the heart. It cannot be dissected like a dead flower, as real nirvana is a living reality. There is a reference to real nirvana also in the New Testament. The kingdom of heaven is not here or there. It is within you. Real heaven is the utter disappearance of self-centeredness in the widest sense of the word. The wise men of Tibet never call themselves Buddhists or claim that they are successors or representatives of Buddha. They could join hands with the very few real Christians who live the spirit of the Bible continually in the little things of their daily lives. Buddha brought a great and radiant light. By giving people a little ersatz light, his self-styled representatives entirely defeat the purpose of the living Buddha. If all these false lights did not exist and there was utter darkness spiritually, people as individuals would step forth and seek the real light which shines forth everywhere radiantly and gratuitously, if we only open our hearts and minds to it. There is an enormous difference between the majority of so-called Buddhists, with the idea of a so-called nirvana dangling before their eyes and leading them away from matter, and the few wise men of Tibet who are in a state of real nirvana here on earth. The latter fully realize spirit and matter. With these men, religion is a constructive and living thing, and not a means of making people weak and sheepish. Dogmatic Buddhism is an organized distortion of the spirit of the living Buddha. Will it be so forever, or will real spirituality be realized someday in Tibet? Asia is at the crossroads. Mankind is at the crossroads. A new conception of life is needed if this world is not to perish. There is the alternative between vertiginous summits and dreadful chasms.